Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome.
And Mom, would you like to tell our listeners who our guest is today?
Yes, I would. It's Randi Susan Myers, and she is the author of The Widow of Wall Street. And it's a novel, and it's one of those novels you cannot put down. I just got captivated, and I just read and read and read. Okay, and she is a best-selling author of Accidents of Marriage, The Comfort of Lies, and The Murderer's Daughters. Her books have been twice finalists for the Mass Book Award and named must-read books by the Massachusetts Center for the Book. She lives with her husband in Boston, where she teaches writing at the Grub Street Writers Center. I think that's great that you're teaching other people to write. And welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. And let me tell you, the weather here in Boston today is exceedingly nice. And I was out gardening for 4 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
It's like some people do yoga or Xanax. I do garden. When I'm outside gardening, it is probably just about the only time in my life when I am not either reading or listening to a book or listening to NPR or just being very interactive with, you know, consuming some information. It's the only thing I can do where I'm totally there.
Right.
So I don't know what that means.
Do you have trouble with squirrels eating your flowers?
We have a lot of – I have found what the squirrels can't – won't let me have. They will not let me plant bulbs.
Oh.
1 year I planted 100 bulbs, and they, by the next day, they had eaten 100 bulbs.
Yeah.
It was like, so I just don't do bulbs. I can't do spring bulbs. But they seem to leave most of the other stuff alone for the most part. They like to dig up my lawn, though. I don't know what they're looking for.
Yeah, I know. Well, they're looking, they're looking for nuts that they buried.
because
like the rest of us, we can't remember where they put anything.
I was going to say that just like me, where are my keys? Where's my nuts?
Well, of course, then there's the rabbits, and the rabbits eat the flowers. They do.
I don't have rabbits here. Other people further out in the suburb. I guess I'm more dead in the city enough so that we don't have the rabbits.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's okay. You're lucky because they do. They love flowers, and they even eat artificial flowers.
Oh, my goodness gracious. They're even worse than my stupid squirrels.
But anyway, we need to talk about your book.
Yeah,
okay.
We do.
I'm
so
ready.
I got
off onto gardening. We could maybe do a whole nother show on gardening, but let's talk about The Widow of Wall Street.
Okay.
What made you decide to write this book? I know what the inspiration behind it was, a certain event in our recent national history. But why did you want to write about that from the wife's point of view?
Yeah.
As I was listening to the news as it was breaking and going on, I became just, you know, certain news stories just grab you. And, and this one absolutely grabbed me, I don't know, for a number of reasons. And one thing is that I did work with criminals for a long time. And I kept thinking, I believe that Ruth Madoff did not know. I believed her when she said it. Don't ask, I don't know why, but I did. And I kept thinking, well, if she didn't know, what in the world is it like to have your whole world turn like that? To learn that everything that you thought you were living was a lie. I mean, even more than finding out, or maybe as much as finding out that your husband is a criminal, a thief of the highest order, it's also how do you look back and make sense of your past? Did it really happen? Was any of it true? And so I really wanted to write that, and I was doing a lot of research, and I, in fact, was lucky enough to meet Diana Enriquez, who wrote The Wizard of Lies. And she really helped me believe what I believed about the wife. And then as I was writing it, I thought, well, how about him? What was going through his head? And
so
that's
was
how
The
I
Wizard
ended
of
up
Lies
it.
About Bernie Madoff?
Yes, yes. Diana Enriquez is a New York Times reporter. Well, I don't think she's with them anymore. And she was the only reporter who had who actually interviewed Madoff many times.
Oh, wow.
And, in fact, that book, which is a very, very big, fat nonfiction book, was made into a movie, an HBO movie with Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer. And I read her book many, many, many times. She's a brilliant writer about money. That was her beat. And I felt like I was writing two books, which made sense because their marriage had two parts, his
right.
and hers.
Right.
And so that's what I was doing, writing his and hers. And so I did an enormous amount of research for the book. So in terms of the spine of the crime, that follows what I unearthed with my research, including reading court records.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The marriage, so that was pretty much true to what I know. The marriage, on the other hand, is where I put my big old fiction hat on.
Okay.
And had a
well, you can't possibly, you never know for sure about that. But the wives in this situation must have wondered, when it was over, must have wondered, could I have done something to change this directory, you know, conjecture? It must be really hard to accept that.
I think it must be very hard to accept it, and it must be even more confusing when you see from, I mean, he has never admitted in real life, Bernie Madoff, when it actually started. The biggest sense that one gets, that I got, that I used in the book, was there when they brought to trial the people who worked with him, who knew, of course he didn't do it alone.
Right.
The one who was his main guy, who I called Charlie in the book, he actually gave state's evidence. Mm. He was the only person who gave it all up. Mm-hmm. And he started working in the business when he was very, very young. And it sounds like I believe that he started this very early on. So as his wife, I would say, my goodness, how did I not see this right from the beginning? But having worked with criminals, I can tell you, they're pretty good at fooling people.
That's why they're criminals.
I mean, in the Widow of Wall Street, it feels like Jake Pierce, the character who's styled after Bernie Madoff, really believed himself that he was going to make it all right someday.
And I think that this is true from what I've read and also from working with the guys. They generally think they're a lot smarter than they are. And they tell themselves a story. All of us do that. We're all the stars of our own show. And we all, at some point in our life, tell ourselves a story to excuse bad behavior, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe not you ladies, but I know.
Yeah. No.
And so I do believe he did think, okay, any day now I'm going to make this right. When it finally came to play is when people who do Ponzi schemes usually fail, which is when the money runs out. And in this case, it was because the economy crashed, the stock market crashed.
You know, I thought if he were really smart, he could have maybe, when there were downturns, showed paper losses so that he didn't have quite so much to make up. Then he might have had a shot at making it up.
You know, greed has no limits. And, you know, the other part of this that is pretty amazing is how much people believed what he said, even though on the face of it, it was totally insane. In fact, interesting story. That won't give away any secrets, but because then the person won't be named. I was with my husband on, of all things, a garden tour in the neighborhood last weekend. It was wonderful. And one of the people, you know, I end up yakking with everybody at their house. And as my husband's like, come on, come on, come on, because with him it's all about, you know, finishing the task. So the people that I was talking with, blah, 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 started talking, I'm a writer, da-da-da-da. Turns out one of their mothers was taken in by Madoff.
Oh, boy.
And was putting all of their children, her grandchildren's college money in it. And she called them up and said, guess what? It's 18% guaranteed. And they said, Mom, it's not possible. That's just not a possible thing. And they mitigated as much as they could, but they couldn't get her to take it out. And she, in fact, you know, lost it all and then was liable for the taxes for years afterwards for the money that they took back. Well, she never got the money because she never took it out. And that's why he couldn't, and why he got into trouble was that as the economy tanked, everybody wanted their money back.
Yeah.
And they wanted their profits and they wanted to lock them in. And, well, we know what happened.
And now the funny thing is, I mean, Bernie Madoff is like the one that we've all heard of, but these things happen all the time.
All the time. I read probably about 10 books on different Ponzi schemes, including one that's called Ponzi, about the original Charles Ponzi. That's a brilliant book. And then I watched some documentaries on different Ponzi schemes. There are so many of them. They're going on right now. That's
I mean,
happens
I'm just,
to be...
I was just Googling Ponzi schemes, and there was a recent Montoya up in Boston, like this year.
Yes.
Raymond Montoya.
Mm-hmm. And when you come down to it, starting with, I'm not saying it was the only one, but the one it's named for, Charles Ponzi, his scheme in Boston, you know, long ago, was also based on this idea that making people believe you can get magic.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the magic beans, you know, from Jack and the Beanstalk.
Really, well, like really they really say, if it's too good to be, if it sounds too good to be true.
Could be true.
It probably
is too good to be true.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I gotta go by that.
I'm trying to remember the name of one. There was one that happened, and I think it was a hedge fund. It was in the, I think, the Boston area. It probably would have been in the early 2000s. And I had a client who was invested in it and got suspicious after a while because the guy's returns were so steady. And he ended up drawing, my client ended up drawing the money out, his money out, and then it did turn out to be a Ponzi scheme. And he actually had, the client's family actually had to repay some of the money they drew out because it wasn't really theirs.
Right, that's the whole thing that happened that got everybody so angry, because the people who took out the money early in the Madoff scheme had it, what it was called, a clawback. They had to give back everything but their original investment because it was ill-gotten gains.
Right.
Just because you think you earned it doesn't mean you really earned it.
Yeah.
And so it's very complicated.
Yeah.
It was a complicated book to write. It was interesting because on the one hand, I'm all of this stuff in my head about financial dealings. I had to, A, know what the right proper thing was to do, because you can't write about crime without knowing what's the legal thing. And I was reading things like stockbroker manuals from the 1950s and 60s, which I got to tell you, not as fascinating as it sounds.
I wanted
to then give it to the reader in ways that was not boring. But I had to understand it enough to then, you know, feed it out.
So did you have an understanding, a fairly good understanding of how the stock market worked and how hedge funds work and so forth before you wrote this book?
I wasn't in any way, I wasn't unknowledgeable, but I wasn't an expert either. I had enough of an understanding, so it wasn't like I was suddenly trying to understand nuclear physics or something, which would be like, whoa. I had an interest in it. I had belonged to a money club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you had, you know, for a while. My husband, luckily, has a very, very good understanding And so I could call him up at any given time and say, remind me again what shorting a stock is. But I did understand the nomenclature. And it is like many things that you research when you're writing, like, for instance, in the Actions of Marriage, I had to really learn about traumatic brain injury. So I do have the ability to immerse myself, do the research, find it fascinating, and then feed it out in little nuggets. And then, like, you learn anything like that, I then forget most of it the minute the book is published.
Oh, right.
And make room for the next thing that I'm going to be learning. But I do find it, I have learned this in writing, you must find the topic interesting.
Well, I have a very good understanding of that subject matter, because my accounting firm actually, we had hedge funds as clients. We did accounting.
Oh my God, I didn't know you had accounting firms.
Yeah. And I know, and I even understand, you know, what kind of things are subject to government audits and which ones aren't, and the, you know, SEC rules and stuff. So I understand all of it. And so for me, the book was a very easy read, but I was curious about somebody who doesn't have that background. And it's, and, you know, mom would be a great test subject for that, and yet she still found it very fascinating.
Oh, yeah. It really was. Like I said, I could not put it down because I don't understand the stock market or anything, but I wanted to know what was going to happen next.
Well, I work really hard at just giving information as needed to get a grasp of it. And trust me, I spent an enormous amount of time on that one. Like, what's the best way to give this information so you're not lost, so that you can get a sense of it? And I thought about it like driving a car. You can drive a car without having to know how it works under the hood in great detail.
Well,
you just have to know the basics, and that's what I thought about it. And the same thing with a computer. You know, you can work a computer without knowing the back end, you know, just operating the front end. And so I was trying to really stick to synthesizing the most need to know, because the page turning part, the gotta know, what Stephen King calls the gotta know that you have to have in a novel, that's all about, is she going to find out? Is he going to get caught? How is he doing this? You know, what's happening with the family? That's the part that, to me, was the most fascinating. The rest was the stuff I had to know very well, but the reader only had to be able to go, oh, okay, I get this.
Now, I found it interesting that Jake didn't really maybe know that much about investing, even though he was running this brokerage firm. It sounded like his brother was handling the details on one side, and then the other side, he wasn't actually doing anything. He was really just a salesperson.
And that was true. One of the things that I read early on about, you know, sometimes I forget what's fact, what's fiction when I'm a fictioner.
Yeah.
but he really did not know much at all about computers. So when he was saying he did it alone, there were people who were saying, he doesn't even barely know how to turn on a computer. There's no way.
Yeah. His own daughter told him that, didn't she? She just couldn't believe. Yeah.
Now, in real life, did his children turn their backs on him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Turned their backs, turned him, everything as it happened in that scene where he says, except for that day, he had two boys, but in terms of what happened to the children, that is different than my fiction, but the germ of all the emotion is there. And the one thing I can say, because it's out there, I mean, Madoff's sons turned him in.
Mm. Wow.
So, you know, this is to me, this was a true Shakespearean tragedy.
Yeah.
In the way of you know, the falling of the family patriarch. Just boom.
Mm-hmm.
He was not. I mean, so many of these people, once they get into that, they're not learning how to invest. They're learning how to invest you into giving them your money.
Wow.
Right. He was good at that.
Yeah, he sure was. And at least in your book, The Widow of Wall Street, Phoebe, his wife, was very much a part of that, even though she didn't know what she was getting people into. She thought that I mean, she was as suckered in as the rest of them, but she was the front person for a lot of the to generate interest.
Yeah, she was used to bring people in. I mean, he trained her how to do that, and she didn't. She thought she was giving people a good investment. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing in real life is that none of their money was, of course, with this. None, you know, their son's money was in it, but theirs wasn't. You know, they were with, you know, whatever, Fidelity or whatever. I mean, of course, he's not going to invest their money.
Now, did the sons? Did they ever recover? Did they both work for the company like the children did in, in your book?
Yes. Okay. They both worked for the company. They were both told to stay away from the wealth management fund. You know, so they worked in the stock brokerage. Mm-hmm. They were forbidden to be involved with the, which in some ways you could see as maybe that was Madoff's way of being fatherly. Not letting them near the, you know, it's very strange, but
well,
they were,
you wouldn't think he'd want them to put their money in it either.
Well, I guess you can't say don't, you know, I mean, how do you say that? But they were totally, they worked there, that was basically their only careers, and they had tragic ends. One committed suicide, and one who had lymphoma while, you know, before, the business was found to be phony, he then ended up dying from that. So, you know, a very tragic end for both children.
And where is Bernie's wife now?
As far as I know, she is actually, strangely enough, in Greenwich, Connecticut, where I set much of the book, which is not where they lived before. And the reason she moved there was because her son, who was then living, lived there. And she wanted to be close to her grandchildren. And so I think she still rents a small apartment there.
And is Bernie still alive?
Yes, he's alive and in prison and a big shot in prison.
Really?
Just like Jake. And just like Jake. A big shot in prison.
Just like Jake. Yeah. And people ask him to for tips, for investment tips in jail. I mean, it's just, you know, you can't make, it's just, it's so... Often the families of criminals are the ones who end up suffering more than the criminals.
Mm-hmm. Well, people are so gullible, and goodness, they really are.
Well, I have an interesting story about that. I don't know if you've heard of that. Actually, there's a guy. His name was Harry Markopoulos, and he was involved with a small wealth management fund. He did all the back end, the math. He was a genius, but not that great with, you know, people, so they had him in the back office, right?
Right.
And it was a two-guy office, as far as I know, and probably support staff. And somebody, one of their clients came in and says, my father died. He had all his money with this guy Madoff. I'm trying to decide what to do. It looks like a great fund. And so he gave it to the front, you know, who gave it to Harry. And Harry did, what do you call it? When you do backwards, I just lost the word. When you configure something backwards. So you try to recreate it. You know the word. And that, we all know the word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reverse engineer.
Yeah.
So he reverse engineered it, and no matter how many times he did it, he could not get it to work. He said, this is virtually impossible to get these returns, because he had the statement. That's all he had was the statement, which were all phony. And when the other partner went to the guy who brought it in, he said, well, maybe you're right, but these returns are great. I'm going to keep my money there. So this is the – and now I don't know if you know, Harry Markopoulos then kept writing to the SEC.
Oh, wow.
Really?
To get them to pay attention. And there's a scene in my book where the SEC goes in.
Yeah.
And that really did happen, except it was really mainly because of Harry Markopoulos. And he did fool them with exactly the method that I wrote about. And Harry Markopoulos was ignored as a nut.
Wow.
And he was completely right. He wrote a book that was a little strange, but I read it. I read every book there was to read.
Oh, gosh.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Randy Susan Myers, author of The Widow of Wall Street.
Well, it's a complicated business to begin with, so most of us don't really know how it works. And, of course, a lot of people don't have money that they want to, you know, invest or anything. I don't know. It was a fascinating book.
It really is interesting how gullible people are and how much they want to believe in it. And I've seen this time and time again with very sophisticated clients who say, oh, there's this investment and it's, you know, this one guy came to me and he wanted me to get other clients to invest in this. And I'm like, no, thank you. But they supposedly, it was these guys that had this sophisticated computer model and they were doing futures and they would, they never lost money because in any given month, once they got 4%, they're up 4%, they would quit trading for that month. So they would never lose in any month.
And so they time it.
Yeah, it's like, okay, but that's assuming that you always make money before you lose it, which doesn't actually happen that way. You know, so you can start out trading in a month and lose money and never regain it in that month. And so this is impossible. But people believed it.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that I found really fascinating was I visit a lot of book clubs, and either by Skype or in person if they're around the Boston area. And they always, I do events, and people always say, well, what's your next book? So when I was doing Accidents of Marriage, and people asked me what my next book was, and I told them The Widow of Wall Street, you know, blah, 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 told them what it was about. Universally, the reaction at that point, before anybody had read the book, it wasn't out yet, was, oh, my God, of course she knew Ruth Madoff. She must have known. Oh, my God, she's guilty of sin. She's more guilty than he is, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, whoa.
Wow.
Why are people so angry that they're basically spitting almost? And as this happened more and more, I found it, I wanted to really investigate what this was about. And I finally was able to suss it out. Everybody wants to think they're above being fooled.
Yeah.
And all of these women, because the book is not really about the finance, it's about the relationship, the marriage. So here's this woman who in my book gets totally bamboozled. And they want to think it can't happen to them. Now, on the other hand, so many women don't have a clue what's going on in their family with money.
Right.
Their husband handles everything. They wouldn't know if he died, they wouldn't know where to find the books. And they want to believe against all odds that they couldn't possibly be in a situation like this, or that their husband could be having an affair. No, it would never happen to them. They would, it's always that woman who was a fool. And that's what I realized, is that we are so afraid of being fooled, we'd rather think that the other woman, whatever she believed, that she's a fool or that she's guilty.
Right.
And a lot of women, after reading the book, have said, oh, yeah, now I see.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I sometimes write these little limited edition books that go along with them. This one's called The Discomfort of Money. And it's about my views on money, women and money, what are the 10 things women should – I have a friend, a woman, who owns a wealth management fund, and she wrote some stuff for me about what are the 10 things women should know. Because, see, I think women need to educate themselves.
Mm. And so what do you do with these books?
Oh, yes, that's true.
What I do is, when any book club that signs up on my site, they get a free copy for the person who contacts me in paper copy, and then I send a electronic copy for them to share with everybody in the club, in the book club.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'll send you one. If you write to me and give me your address, I'll send it to you.
Okay, perfect. So
yeah.
tell me a little bit about how you became a writer, because and your background is working with victims of domestic violence.
No, actually, I worked with the batterers.
Oh, you worked with the batterers. Okay.
I have had a lot of different jobs in my life, but I was working for the city of Boston, the assistant director for all the community centers in the city, and then from there I went to a violence intervention program. It's a batter intervention program where they were ordered, and it wasn't a counseling, it was teaching. Mm-hmm. Methods of nonviolence, but it was really keeping tabs on them with probation and blah, blah, blah. But throughout all of that, writing and books were always my first love. In fact, I co-authored a book when I was in my 20s called A Couples with Children, a nonfiction book. And writing was always what I wanted to do more than anything, but I took some other steps. I got married at 19, a brilliant decision. I was so smart. I cannot tell you how smart that was. Had children.
Well, I was even smarter. I got married at 18.
So we're both brilliant. Shocking, we got divorced, and then was raising my kids and sending them to college, you know, all those good things you have to do. So my dream of writing had to take a back burner, but I was always writing. And then I got remarried to a wonderful man. I gave up my bad habits of – I have a PhD in bad boys, in bad men. So I let go of that, was now married to a wonderful, wonderful man, was able to stop working 60 hours a week and spend more time on what I really love. And I published my first novel, The Murderer's Daughters, when I was 57.
Wow.
And that was great, you know, with St. Martin's Press. And so it was a bit of a journey. But the nice thing was after it took so long, when I finally got the right agent, she sold The Murderer's Daughters in 8 days in a pre-em. So that was very nice. It was a long journey to a quick sell. That was nice.
Now, what is The Murderer's Daughters about? It sounds like it's also exploring the family, what the effect on the family of a criminal.
Yep, it's exactly what it is. The Murderer's Daughters is about two sisters who witnessed their father murder their mother.
Oh, my.
And then what their life is like for the next 40 years. Now, at that point when I wrote it, I was working with batterers, but beyond that, I must preface this by saying this wasn't a successful crime, but my father tried to murder my mother.
Oh.
He didn't succeed, and she was fine, but it was that book was sort of this huge what if.
Wow.
And yeah, it takes place over many, many, many years. And I was very lucky with that book because it became the Target book club pick for the country. So that was really lovely.
Wow. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. It was quite a book to write. And
how long did you work on writing it?
The Murderer's Daughters?
Yeah. How long did you spend writing it?
About 18 months.
Oh, wow. That's pretty fast for a first novel.
Yeah. Well, I was writing some other stuff before that.
So did you write other novels that you did not try to publish or that you did try and were not able to publish?
I did have novels that thank God, were not published. but the one, there was books I was working on before The Murderer's Daughters that didn't quite gel. I have a habit of starting something, letting it rest, and then going back to it. It's sort of like they just kind of cascade until mm-hmm. I figure out what am I missing here. And so there were some novels I started before The Murderer's Daughters that then got published afterwards after I was like, oh, I know what's wrong with that book. Because I won't let it out of my hands until I'm sure that I've hit my own personal sweet spot.
So what is The Comfort of Lies about?
The Comfort of Lies is about three women all involved in one young child. The woman who gave birth to the child, the woman who adopted the child, and the woman who didn't know that her husband had had the fathered the child.
Oh.
And all three lives cast, you know, collide suddenly.
Wow. Oh, I bet that's interesting.
And we also have the point. So we have all three women's point of view. And then because it demanded it, it was screaming at me, it was yelling at me. For a while, we have the point of view of the man, the father.
Mm, wow.
And then all three families somehow come to not come together like living together, but they are all, you know, they intersect very strongly. And we don't know what's going to happen.
That sounds fascinating. And the actor.
How old was the child in this story?
Six.
Oh, so they didn't really have to. It wasn't like they were a teenager or beyond that they had to deal with this. So.
Okay. Well, actually, I ended up. This is an interesting story. When I wrote that book, I had an epilogue, so that you could see what where the child was many years later.
Oh, good.
And my editor at the time was like, "Oh, I don't think so," and I didn't fight for it like I usually fight. So now I have up on my website the epilogue for anybody who wants to read it.
Okay.
Because I needed to know what was happening with her. I became so invested in that child.
Well, of course.
I really, really needed to know how she was doing.
Wow.
Well, the whole thing was that about that child's life. I mean,
yes,
you know,
from different points of view, and everybody,
yeah,
you know, having different reactions to her, including the father she had never met.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting book to write.
Yeah.
I'll bet.
And Accidents of Marriage, I got the impression that was about a traumatic brain injury that occurred and how that impacted
the marriage.
Well, it's
actually about what happened. Every action has a reaction, and what happens when the man's emotional instability. Well, emotional abuse. I mean, you know, basically think of the guy who, when he loses his temper, starts yelling and screaming. Might be perfectly lovely the rest of the time, but there you are driving along and, well, what happens if it causes an accident that severely injures the wife?
Oh.
And that's told from the point of view of the husband, the wife, and the 16-year-old daughter who ends up having to do a lot of care of the family of their three children in the family.
Oh, wow.
And that one was really something for me because it takes us through the different stages of traumatic brain injury. And I've heard from a lot of people who have survived traumatic brain injury telling me, asking me if I went through it because they felt like I hit it just right.
Mm.
So that,
well,
that made me feel wonderful.
That's quite a compliment, yes, indeed.
Yeah, yeah. They asked me if I was a nurse who worked with people.
You certainly like to deal with complex situations.
I do. I really do.
Maybe you like to write them so you don't have to live them.
Well, I gave up drama in my life for drama on the page.
Good for you.
And
good.
I do think that in order to be a good writer, this is my own personal opinion, that you know, like when people who drink while they write I don't drink hardly. I mean, I just don't do those things. You know, my idea of a fun night home is, you know, eating chili with my husband while we watch all the reruns of Frasier or something.
Yeah.
So you're not a wild woman.
Oh my goodness, no, no. Gardening for too many hours while my husband's saying, "Come in and drink water," is probably as wild as I get.
Well, there's enough wild situations in the world that you can write about that you don't have to live them.
Yes. Oh yes, that's for sure. And writing soothes me. It really does. I mean, I did have a hard upbringing. Yeah, you know, I came up hard, my sister and I. And, you know, my father, who, you know, had his problems, he also had drug problems and alcohol problems and blah, blah, blah. So I really like calmness in my world, you know. And like many children who come up with, you know, parents who are either needy or, you know, have addictive personalities, you tend to be a caretakers.
Right.
And want everything to be just. So, and I love writing is what really soothes me more than anything. I'm a bit of a workaholic.
Randy, would you like to read from The Widow of Wall Street for us?
Well, if you can bear listening through my Brooklyn accent.
No problem. I mean, these are New Yorkers, after all.
That's true. That's a good point. My husband always says that when I'm on stage or on the radio, my accent gets stronger. I don't know why. Okay, I will do my best, okay? And this is the first chapter, and just so you know what I do for public readings, I take the chapter and I abridge it so that you get the full sweep of it having to listen to a long, long, long time. So a lovely description is gone, okay?
Okay.
Phoebe never hated her husband more than when she visited him in prison. She arrived at the grimy motel close to midnight. So many never envisioned experiences, riding a dingy Greyhound bus, drowning ramen noodles in a coffee maker, choosing clothes to wear to Raybrook Federal Correction Institution, and then envisioning the choice through her husband's eyes. Each month, Jake became more of an albatross, and yet, even now, through tooth-grinding anger, Phoebe still seeked his approving smile and the satisfaction of soothing his melancholy. Phoebe worried how long she would continue making this trip. Come on, stay longer. She dreaded hearing those words Jake repeated every visit. Otherwise, come Saturday and Sunday, not just for a measly few hours. She'd stare, just as she had before, silent, hoping her eyes might express her true feelings. Screw yourself, Jake. Her husband, once a titan, a god, now whines like a child. What she said, a few hours is plenty. What she didn't say, 2 days would kill me. What he said, getting out after 3 hours must be nice. What he probably meant, I hate you for being free. What she said, staying here must be hard. What she didn't say, leaving is deliverance from you. Then she changed the topic. In their world of off-limit issues, the kids, Jake's guilt, her lack of money, not knowing this man, this fraud of a husband who steamrolled over her desperation to unravel the tangled skein of their past. She carried her laptop to bed. Messages from frightening strangers stuffed her inbox. The distraught and inflamed Jake haters found Phoebe no matter how many times she changed her email provider. She tried holding back, but unable to resist, she opened prisonmessages.com. Within moments, she found herself captured by call girl's question. Would you be angry if your man showed off your sexy pics? The man she thought she'd married would have gouged up the eyes of any man trying to see her naked. But today's Jake would likely sell pictures of her to the highest bidder. Like a man vowing to stay off porn sites, she slammed her laptop closed. 10 minutes later, she reopened it, unwrapping a packet of peanut butter crackers as she waited for the machine to come fully alive. She munched as she scrolled through the topics. Prison weddings, legal help, loving a life. Phoebe lurked in chat rooms, reading, trying to learn something about Jake's world. She clicked loving a lifer, despite knowing her love for Jake died more each day. After his confession, Jake had morphed into that awful relative, attached to your flesh like a parasite, one you were forced to care for because he lived on in your family tree. She scrolled down the forum, reading titles. Thread, what bonds you to your lifer? Or her daughter there, she'd fold her arms and ask, exactly, Mom, how can you continue choosing him over us? Phoebe would again beg her daughter to understand why leaving Jake alone, pummeled by a world's anger, seemed like kicking him as he lay on the ground. Jake could only lean on her. She became his security blanket. He became her prison. Thread, I am exhausted. Yes. They were all tired of facing their angry men on visiting days, tired of their locked-up men's desperation boiled with resentment, these overly sensitive men offended by their need for women living on the outside. They exhausted their women, these men. Thread, what are the best traits of your lifer? inexhaustible stores of these women's love dust sprinkled the screen. Despite having committed crimes so awful they received life sentences, these men still inspired their women to enumerate their good qualities. Had they forgiven them their murders, their rapes, their thieving? Jake swore no singular moment had marked the beginning of his thievery, but he lied. Everything began somewhere. He hadn't slipped into this Byzantine plot. His had been no banana peel of a crime. And now he talked about the guys. People imagine prisons as all fear and knives, but the truth didn't unfold so tough. These guys, they cooked. They shared books. They were his goddamn buddies. Her entire marriage, she'd battled against being known only as Jake's wife. Now, she feared the battle could be over for good. Phoebe had become two almost spectral things, a widow to a living man and a childless mother. And that's the prologue.
And,
oh boy.
Yep, that gets you right in.
Thank you.
Early life I found very interesting. And did you have to do much research about, you know, what life would have been like in that neighborhood, in that area, for someone in her type of family?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn.
Okay.
So big advantage for me, right?
Yes.
And I wasn't as old as the character, but I wasn't that much younger. So I had those two things there. Plus, which I did what I always do when I'm writing a book. I go to the neighborhood, and I drive around till I find the house I wanted to be in. So I actually always find my characters' houses. So my husband and I took a trip to Brooklyn. We went up and down the streets in that neighborhood, which is very close to where I grew up, and took pictures of, I mean, I have... That street's a real street, and I described it exactly as it is, and so that was not that hard. In terms of getting in touch, though, with exactly what was happening then, one of the things I like to do is to go to first sources, by which I mean not sticking to the computer. Mm-hmm. I go on eBay, and I bought a ton of magazines from all the decades I followed. Because when you get those old Life magazines and the New York Post and the Vogues and all of those things, you get to really see the ads and everything exactly as it was. It's much more accurate than just going to Pinterest, although I do my own Pinterest, too. And then I buy old books and I watch old movies and I really immerse myself in that time. And then there's these books that are just wonderful from the New York Times that I always use, called The Times of the 60s, The Times of the 70s, The Times of the 80s. And it has the articles, the top news articles of the arts, the entertainment, you know, in terms of money, what's going on. So I really did a lot of research to make sure that I got it right, because I've read books where they get it wrong and it makes me insane.
Interesting. So how much time do you spend researching compared to writing? Is it like one-third, two-thirds, or one-fourth, three-fourths?
Probably about maybe like one-quarter, three-quarters. Yeah. I mean, I have to limit myself because honestly, and so many writers are like this, we're all like this. Yeah, we have to force ourselves to stop. I mean, because basically you're calling reading work. And if you love to read. And I love researching. And even when it's not a topic I find super fascinating, like, for instance, like when I had to really dig deep into the crime and the stockbroker, I write myself reports. So I take all the information, I put it into a three-leaf binder, and then I take out the most important things and I write myself a little book on it so that I have it there. And that's how it gets into my thick skull, by writing it down.
Wow. Do you... As you're doing this research, do you come up with ideas for other stories, other books?
Oh, I'm always having ideas. I have a whole file of books I will write if I don't die soon, you know, because I have so many different ideas. Finding ideas is never my problem. It's, you know, although sometimes I start a book and I put it aside because it doesn't feel right. I've written as much as like 6 chapters and said, nope, not feeling it.
Really?
So sometimes you have a false start that you might go back to or you might not.
Wow.
But I have to wait for ideas to grab me.
Now, are you one of these writers who will write very, very quickly and then go back later to do edits, or do you write more slowly and edit as you write?
No, I'm a fast writer who then goes back and edits, because I'm not somebody who like agonizes over each sentence. I like to write the fast, sloppy first draft, get down the bones, because I love revision. I really love revision, but I like doing revision layers. So I have my first draft, then I do my macro edit, you know, then I do a little more intense, and then I start working for the beauty of the sentences, and then I do, you know, all up until I'm doing my 10 times what I call the dental draft, where I'm picking at every little tiny piece of plaque and, you know, getting it just right.
And so is there one of those steps that you prefer to the others?
That's a really interesting question. Each one has its fun and its not fun parts. The most fun is probably taking the first draft and then getting all the ideas to sink in. Although I do love when I'm working with the micro also.
Mm.
So, you know, each one has its joy. Each one gets to a point where you're like, I'm going to kill myself if I have to see these one more time. And, you know, my husband's always like, how can you read that same book so many times?
And Randy, do you always know how the story is going to end before you start writing?
No, I'm a tremendous outliner. I am a big believer in putting down some structure so I can use my imagination, but I generally do not know the very end.
Ah.
That culminates, and the ending is like me walking around 1,000 times trying to hit it. I have a sense of where it's going, but the absolute culmination comes, like for instance, with The Murderer's Daughters, I wrote the first 3/4, slow, but not fast. And then I didn't know what I was going to do, how I was going to put the end of that book together. And I walked and then suddenly, boom, it all came to me. And I wrote the final quarter in probably 3 weeks of just a flash.
Whoa.
So it's generally, the characters are living so deeply inside me. I don't know in the beginning what those characters are going to really do in the end. Because I set them up in some horrible situation, and then I have to figure out, how am I going to get them out of this?
Right.
And I generally write the ending many, many, many times. The ending and the beginning I write repeatedly until I literally feel in my gut that, okay, now I'm satisfied.
Wow. And so it sounds like when it's done, you know it. There's no question about it.
Yep, when it's done, I know it, and that's when I send it to, although I have a writer's group that, you know, we've been together a long time that I share with during the process. And, you know, we are very hard on each other. that's very, very helpful. In fact, when I first started The Widow of Wall Street, I was setting the beginning of it when Phoebe first finds out about the crime. And because of their feedback on, like, what's her motivation to do, I ended up going all the way back to the 60s.
Mm. Oh, yeah. So I think that was great.
You need a good group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mom, do you have any more questions?
Well, let's see. I had some written down, but she answered most of them.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah. But I want to tell you, the topics and questions for discussion that you have at the end of the book were really good and very helpful. And also the Enhance Your Book Club section. I really appreciated that.
I'm so glad.
It added a great deal to my enjoyment of the book. It really did.
I am really glad to hear that. And make sure that you write to me and give me your address so I can send you some fun stuff.
All right.
You can write to me right through my website and or through Elise, and I'll send you some presents.
Perfect. Before we finish, what's next?
Well, my next book is all done, and I just got the first iteration of the cover today, and I was really thrilled with it, so that's nice. Wow. And the title is Wasted, W-A-I-S-T-E-D.
Oh.
And it is about how far will women go to lose weight? And how crazy do women get about their weight? And what happens when a group of women end up in a place that they think is going to be almost like this wonderful spa-like place where they're doing a documentary and turns out to be not that?
Wow.
How
that's
going to
be, oh boy.
Yeah. That's coming out in May.
And where did the idea for this come from? Is it based on anything, any real story?
I've been wanting to write a book about women and weight for years because, it is such an intense topic for me. It is such an intense topic for so many women. This is a book not just about women and their weight, but women and mothers, their relationship with their mothers and their weight. Mother-daughter.
well, that's one thing we never had any issue about. We never talk about weight.
You'll be interested in seeing, because this is the two main characters who are point of view characters have totally different relationships with their mothers overweight and with their husbands and with the whole world. But women, you can't walk through this world without being affected by, my first line, I believe, is everyone hates a fat woman.
Yeah.
It just goes from there. And when I was writing this book, I either wanted to eat every minute or I wanted to never eat at all. So it was, it was.
Wow. Well, that sounds fascinating. It really
does.
Well, and we are out of time.
No
way. Well, thank you, lady. You were great.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Writer's Voices. And, Mom, do you have any final words?
I do. Actually, it's the last two sentences of her book, and it says, "Fortunate are those who can dry the tears of others. Blessed are those who can hold their family and friends close." Amen.
Oh,
all right.
Thank you.
See you all next week on Writer's Voices.